Not Your Sweetheart, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When Palestinian-American Yasmin Mjali moved to the West Bank, she was surprised how many women there, including herself, were experiencing sexual harassment and abuse, but not talking about it.
It was time to start some sort of movement around ways that we can lift it out of the shadows and start discussing how we can start tackling the issue.
So she launched hashtag Not Your Habibti, meaning not your sweetheart. Plus, Canada's national anthem goes gender neutral by changing the line in all thy sons command to in all of us command.
You know, as I say, how do you explain to a 5-year-old girl that you're singing all thy sons command? But all right, dear, that includes you. Well, no, it doesn't.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Friday. Thanks for making it. We start today with a couple of stories from our Across Women's Lives desk, both about the fight for women's rights in the Middle East. In a few minutes, we'll tell you about Iran's Girls of Revolution Street, but first to another movement, a campaign and a hashtag called Not Your Habibti. That's Arabic for sweetheart. Palestinian-American artist and activist Yasmin Mjali is behind the project. So you started this project last October, and it began in an intriguing way. You set up a table with a typewriter in downtown Ramallah in front of a banner that read, "Do not stay silent on harassment." Now, that banner is obviously speaking to women. What did you want women to do?
I was encouraging them to share their very personal stories of sexual harassment and street harassment in a very public space.
And in the West Bank, I gather that the typewriter itself is a powerful symbol. Can you explain that?
The typewriter in Palestinian territories is used to type up travel permits. So any Palestinian living in the West Bank or Gaza looking to leave the territories to travel into the rest of the world or to enter into Israel must apply for permits for the right to movement. And so these permits are actually still to this day typed up on Hebrew typewriters. And so I've taken the typewriter as a motif for this right to movement so that when women come forward to me and dictate their stories of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and I take them down, it is in its own way sort of permitting them their right to movement again after being hopefully emotionally freed.
So you encourage women to type these stories on this typewriter. Did they write them anonymously?
Yes. There were very, very few women who were willing to speak, even if they had only given a first name. Every single story I've received has been given anonymously.
So Yasmin, what inspired you to start this project?
So I was inspired by my own experience with street harassment and sexual harassment. Coming from a very small town in the United States and moving back to my roots here in Palestine, I wasn't really quite prepared for the sexual harassment that I'd endured upon moving to Palestine. And so I realized that as it had become a daily norm as I went about my business, I had sort of started to tolerate it, brush it under the rug and think this is normal. So I would keep my eyes down and my mouth shut as it would happen to me, realizing that as I kept doing this, I was in some silent way only reinforcing the idea that it was okay. And so I decided that it was time to start some sort of movement and a social dialogue around ways that we can lift it out of the shadows and start discussing, first of all, why it's an issue and then how we can start tackling the issue.
Was your Not Your Habibti movement kind of sparked by the Me Too movement?
Actually, no. The Me Too movement happened just about the same week that the Not Your Habibti movement had started. It was actually perfectly timed coincidence.
And how would you say Not Your Habibti is different from Me Too?
I think it's different in a few ways. Because Me Too started initially as a hashtag, the number of times that the hashtag was used was meant to illustrate just how widespread and how common and how universal the harassment was. Whereas Not Your Habibti did not start as a hashtag. It was this socially engaged art project on the streets in which women were invited to come forward and share personal stories. And so even though Not Your Habibti stories were far fewer in number, they were different in that they were very personal rather than just sort of this hashtag without a story attached to it.
So Yasmin, what have you done with the accounts that were typed up, these accounts of harassment that were typed up? Who's read them?
many people have read them. I can't say for sure as they're all online at the moment. Well, not all. A good number of them are online. I'm hesitant to share all of them because it's an ongoing series. And the idea is that at the end of the series, they will be displayed in an exhibition that will be exhibited in Rome, New York, Krakow, and of course, Ramallah. So at this point, it's young women, it's mothers who've read this and actually shared it with their daughters, Palestinians here in Palestine, Palestinians in the diaspora, and Arabs living all over. I've received messages from women who've read these stories from all over.
Are you trying to engage Palestinian men on this issue as well?
Yes, and I do so in different ways. So Not Your Habibti is designed just for women because especially here in Palestine, as soon as a man is in the scene, in the environment, a woman, just by sheer subconscious training, is quiet and will not open up. But under my other projects like Dear Mr. Prime Minister and Waed, my third typewriter project, I invite both genders to come forward because those are the stories that are sent to the Prime Minister. And I think it's more powerful when those letters and opinions come from our society as a whole rather than just half of the society.
I mean, this is a pretty sensitive topic for Palestinians, and you're Palestinian-American. Do you get any flack for kind of bringing this up in such a public way?
I do. Such issues of sexual harassment and really any gender-based issues are taboo. I've had women themselves come up to me and say that you should not be trying to tackle gender-based issues. We have an occupation to be dealing with. So I receive flack for, I guess, maybe ignoring what others see as the larger issue. And I do as well, because to deviate from the norm and to call attention to what are these subliminal social issues dubs me as a bad girl of the Arab world.
Yasmin Njali, a Palestinian artist who lives in Ramallah on the West Bank, she's calling attention to sexual harassment among Palestinians under the Not Your Habibti hashtag. Yasmin, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing. Thanks so much.
Here are some other women breaking the rules. In Iran, some women have been posting pictures of themselves without a headscarf. This is a defiant move, considering that it's compulsory for women to cover their hair in public. So far, about 30 of them have been arrested. The World's Shirin Jafari has been looking into this. So what's going on, Shirin?
Late December, Marco, a video appeared online of a young woman in Tehran, and she was standing on top of a utility box on a sidewalk.
A utility box, kind of like one of those power boxes for electricity, right?
Yeah, in Iran, there are these utility boxes. I really don't know what they're for, but anyway. So this woman was standing on a utility box, and she was not wearing a headscarf. She had taken it off and attached it to a stick, and she was waving it around silently. So the video went viral and people began asking, who is this woman and why is she risking arrest and intimidation in such a bold, visual, public way?
Yeah, so may I ask the same question? Who is she and why did she do this?
For a couple of days, she remained this sort of mysterious figure. She became known as the girl from Revolution Street because people thought that's where the video was taken. Mm. And then there were reports that she'd been arrested, but later on, a human rights activist in Iran said that she has been released. And it turns out that her name is Vida Movahed, and she had taken her scarf off in protest to the mandatory hijab in Iran.
Right. And what Vida started didn't stop with her, right?
No, since Vida stood up on that box and waved her white scarf, a number of other women have done the same in various cities across Iran. There are pictures and videos online that show women standing in public spaces without a head covering and following what Vida did. This is not a widespread movement yet, but it's been gaining more and more steam.
Right. And if you've seen any of the videos, I mean, it's kind of dramatic. Have you been able to speak with any of these women who've participated in this protest?
Yeah. In fact, I managed to get in touch with a young woman in Tehran. She's a 23-year-old student. She didn't give me her name, but she told me that after she saw videos of Vida and other women online, she really felt huge admiration for what they did, and she felt kind of guilty that she's not taking part. So on Wednesday, she decided to walk the distance between her home and school, not wearing her hijab. And she said, it's not a very long distance, but still, it took a lot of courage.
Yeah, did you ask her, like, what kind of courage it took for her to do this and what that was like?
She said she was terrified at first. She really didn't know what's going to happen. She could have been arrested. According to the law, if a woman doesn't cover up in public, she could spend time in jail and she could also be fined. But this woman said that, to her surprise, people didn't pay much attention. She said one or two people thought that her scarf has kind of slipped off, and they told her, hey, maybe you want to pull that back up. But she said there was no confrontation, and she felt good, and she really felt emboldened.
Would she do this again?
I wondered the same thing. She said she doesn't know. It's too risky. She said she's not ready yet to put herself out there like that. So she's going to wait and see.
Yeah, but she did it once, and other women are taking these risks. I'm just wondering kind of why they're doing this now.
The young woman I got in touch with said she's not against the hijab. She thinks that women should have the option to choose whether they want to cover it or not. And to be clear, the fight against compulsory hijab in Iran isn't new, Marco. One human rights activist said this week that the push to change these laws began the day the hijab became compulsory,
right
after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. So women have been fighting for decades, and they have made small changes. I mean, if you look at the way women dress in Iran today, especially in more urban areas, it's very different from 20, 30, 40 years ago. Having said that, we shouldn't forget that for some women in Iran, the full covering is what they prefer. But these protesters say we should be able to have an option and we shouldn't be forced to do it.
So where do these women see this movement going?
I asked a woman in Tehran if she thinks this is just temporary, that women, you know, will challenge the laws for a while and then they'll back down because of pressure from the government and then just move on. I mean, just yesterday, Iranian police said it arrested about 30 people connected to this campaign. But this woman said she's really hopeful that this campaign doesn't die out, that more women get involved. And speaking of people getting more involved, men have also participated. I saw a couple of photos of men standing on a utility box, doing the same thing, holding a scarf on a stick. So it's not just women taking part.
Yeah, a reminder that sometimes a utility box is more than just a utility box. The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks so much for this.
No problem, Marco.
Looking ahead to next week on the show, I speak with Nigerian playwright Ifeoma Fafunwa. Her latest work might make you rethink your ideas about the Me Too movement.
His desire determines your value. His interest sets the price of your stock on the market. And sisters, your bubble bursts at 30.
This piece says to the victim, it's about you. Stop now, make your own change, shift your mindset about you and what's possible for you and what's possible for women in the world, and get to work. Because if you sit around and wait to be handed power from the people in power, you're never going to get it. Nobody's going to give up power voluntarily. Nobody. No, it's not instinctive.
He said I couldn't do it. She said, don't even try. They said, you are a woman. What do you know? Hey! I reject all limitations placed on my life's expectation.
Hear Word, a Nigerian play that's all about breaking a culture of silence. That's next week here on The World. And coming up later on the show, a family torn apart by deportation reunites in Mexico. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Unless you've got a personal connection to Afghanistan, like a loved one who has served or is serving there, the country and its conflicts can seem distant. But here's news that will make Afghanistan more concrete for you. The International Criminal Court in The Hague is considering whether to authorize an official war crimes inquiry for Afghanistan. Judges from the ICC are to begin examining written submissions from victims. And here's the part that should concern us. The suspected perpetrators include not only the Taliban and ISIS, but also Afghan government forces and the CIA. We should warn you that some of the alleged crimes are shocking. My BBC colleague Sikandar Kermani is in Islamabad and just returned from Kabul. I asked him what the CIA was supposed to have done.
So the period that's under potential investigation, that the prosecutors asked permission from the ICC to authorize an investigation into, would be from May 2003 onwards. That's basically when Afghanistan signed up to the International Criminal Court. And so that would include some prisoners who were held in Bagram Detention Center outside Kabul, which is a detention center that was established by the Americans and then later handed over to the Afghans. And many of the people who ended up in Guantanamo Bay, including some of those who are still currently in Guantanamo Bay, went through Bagram. I spoke to the charity Reprieve, which campaigns often on behalf of people who are in Guantanamo Bay. And they said that some of the men who they were writing submissions on behalf of to the ICC said that they had been tortured, that they had been humiliated, that they'd been placed in stress positions for extended periods of time, that they had been beaten on their genitals, and they had been psychologically abused. And they believe that these abuses were carried out at the behest of top commanders.
When you say top commanders, are you talking about top American commanders or top Afghan National Army commanders?
Oh, they're certainly Reprieve are talking about top American commanders.
Gotcha.
And top figures within the CIA and potentially senior political figures as well. But the problem is that America isn't signed up to the International Criminal Court. And not only that, but it's concluded treaties with a number of countries, including Afghanistan, saying that these countries will not ever hand over American personnel to the ICC. And in 2002, in fact, Congress passed a law saying that U.S. authorities were allowed to use all means necessary to free any American citizens who were ever detained for trial at the ICC. So some people rather derisively called that the Hague Invasion Act, because it, in theory, could authorize military force for American forces to bust into The Hague, where the ICC is situated, and free any detained American personnel.
So what has been the U.S. response to the ICC suggestions of an inquiry?
The U.S. authorities have basically so far said that whilst they do believe that it's important that the insurgent groups like the Taliban are held to account, they've said that they believe an ICC investigation is both unwarranted and unjustified. So it seems that they certainly wouldn't be cooperating with any ICC investigation whatsoever. But the ICC is kind of under pressure itself at the moment, because so far it's been seen to be primarily focused on cases relating to Africa. And a lot of African countries are quite resentful of that. And it's made the ICC seem, in some people's eyes, as if it's too scared to take on really politically sensitive cases.
So given that the U.S. has not signed onto the ICC and there are all these aspects of plausible deniability, are people at the ICC kind of realistic about where this could all go, at least with the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I was speaking to this group, Reprieve, for example, who's writing these submissions on behalf of a number of men who were either current or former Guantanamo detainees. And they were basically saying that they hope, of course, that there will be an investigation and potential charges leveled. But I think for a lot of people, even the symbolism of an investigation and charges, even if those people never are actually physically brought to court, would be quite powerful. And of course, it would be a very strong statement against the U.S. or against these individuals from the U.S. If they were to ever be charged, because technically, any time they travel to a country who is a signatory to the ICC, then that country is duty-bound to hand them over to the ICC.
Sikandar, are there names? Have any specific individuals, either Afghan or American, been identified by the ICC yet as possible suspects?
We certainly know some of the names that have cropped up in people's written submissions. And one of the most high-ranking, certainly within Afghanistan, is the current vice president, General Abdul-Rashid Dostum. Mm. He's actually basically in de facto exile right now in Turkey after a really grim allegation against him from a political rival called Ahmed Eşci, who says that Dostum ordered a number of his guards to basically sodomize him and then film it. I was speaking to him in Kabul, and Dostum never appeared in court in relation to these allegations, but his spokesman has denied that Ishchi was ever sexually assaulted or detained by anyone related to Dostum.
Right. Well, we should make clear that those allegations have not been proven, but I thought Dostum was one of the U.S. allies. Wasn't he like one of the first warlords to join with U.S. Special Forces back in the invasion in 2001?
Dostum's someone who's kind of changed various sides during various years. Yeah, he was actually originally a general in the Communist Army in Afghanistan, and then switched sides and joined the Mujahideen fighting against the Soviets. And yeah, he was part of the General Northern Alliance that was fighting against the Taliban after 2001, and that's partly why he was able to become a figure in the government.
Well, it strikes me that you've got a guy like Dostum who is part of an alliance that basically is the Afghan government. And if he's being prosecuted by the International Criminal Court, I mean, doesn't that just make things in Afghanistan with the government so much more unstable?
Absolutely, potentially. I mean, Dostum is someone who, like I said, he is in de facto exile, but he's someone who still has political allies. He's someone who is certainly a very powerful person, particularly amongst the Uzbek community in Afghanistan, which is one of the various ethnicities that make up Afghanistan. And he'd long been seen as a kind of ruler of the Uzbek population in Afghanistan. And there's still a lot of Afghan Uzbeks who have a lot of respect for him. So absolutely. I mean, the domestic political situation in Afghanistan is very complicated. Right now, at the moment, there's a kind of standoff between the Afghan president and the governor of a province in the north, because the president tried to basically sack him, and the governor's refused to step down. And that governor is, as it happens, it seems, a current ally of Dostum's as well.
When will we know for sure if the ICC launches this inquiry or not, Sikander?
There's no deadline by which time the judges have to make a decision. On the 31st of January, just a few days ago, that was the final date on which victims could send in their submissions to the court. So that period is done now. The judges will now be looking at those submissions and other kind of legal arguments to decide whether to authorize this request by the prosecutor to open an investigation. It could be months. It could be longer.
My colleague with the BBC, Sikander Kermani, speaking with us from Islamabad. Thanks very much, Sikander.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Living in Arizona, Katerina Barron always trusted the police.
Law enforcement is there to protect you. They're supposed to keep your family together. They're the good guys. After being married to someone undocumented, I no longer feel that way.
Her husband was deported, and now their family is hoping to build a new life in Mexico. That story just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman here with The World. It's a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We talk a lot on the show about American immigration laws, especially lately. But all countries have ways to regulate immigration. Mexico's immigration laws, for example, focus on family unity. They also make it easier for U.S. citizens to live there on tourist visas and become legal residents. This reality brings us to Katerina Barron and her family. You might remember that we introduced you to them last August. Barron is a U.S. citizen, but her husband is Mexican and was deported. The family decided to move to Mexico to stay together.
We're almost to Mexico. The Mexican
Yep.
That was their five-year-old back in June. Reporter Valeria Fernandez has been following the family story and recently headed to their new home in central Mexico.
Should I bring your original birth certificate, too?
Katerina Barron opens manila envelopes with documents at her home in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. Her toddlers, 2 and 5, watch cartoons.
It's just so funny how the tables have turned.
Not long ago, Katerina was in Arizona trying to stop her husband's deportation. Now, she is the one trying to get legal residency in Mexico.
I think that's it. Oh, and then our passport.
Katerina met her husband, Jesus, in Mesa, Arizona, through friends. He came to the U.S. when he was a toddler from Mexico. Katerina said he grew up culturally like an American.
We both have high school diplomas from Mesa, Arizona. Mesa. It just blows my mind.
When Jesus married Caterina, a U.S. citizen, in 2015, they thought he could get papers if he cleaned up his record. There was a DUI from 8 years ago. Because Jesus had been deported before, there was no way for him to stay in the U.S. legally. So the family moved with him to Mexico.
Yeah, where we used to live, it was a major road, so he couldn't do this.
That's Jesus on a family outing to get tacos, walking the small streets here, much different than Arizona's big freeways.
You know what we should get for a pet?
What?
A baby pet chihuahua.
Chihuahua?
A chihuahua.
Oh, a chihuahua.
Those kind of dogs.
You want a chihuahua?
Yeah.
Dad would love a chihuahua.
Adero is their 5-year-old boy. He goes to a bilingual school. The move was tough on him. He misses his friends. Caterina is trying to navigate some of this by reading parenting books, but she can feel at a loss. She tells her son it's okay to be angry. She's felt that too. Caterina is also learning some Spanish, sometimes with cab drivers.
Es la última casa.
She also watches cartoons in Spanish with Sedona, her 2-year-old girl. Sedona just became a Mexican citizen through her dad, while Caterina is working on getting her permanent residency so she can work legally. In the U.S., she was in college to become an elementary school teacher. For decades, San Miguel de Allende has attracted Americans, retirees, artists, writers. About 10,000 U.S. citizens live here. It's colonial, peaceful, lots of cafes, signs in English, and U.S. citizens can stay for up to 6 months on a tourist visa. Many just go back and forth. Most Americans choose to live here, but the Barrons felt forced because of Jesus' deportation, and San Miguel seemed like a good spot to land, especially for Caterina and the kids.
That's where, in the castle. Right there.
This is why I fell in love with it.
There's fireworks like all the time. They celebrate like everything here.
Oh my gosh, I just stabbed myself with this.
You did? Are you okay?
It really hurt.
For a while, the Barrons lived in an apartment on a cobblestone street with a view of green mountains and colorful houses. Rent was $360 a month. That can be expensive here, though, with a minimum wage less than $5. And Jesus has been the breadwinner, working as a busboy and then a private driver. So the family just moved to a cheaper place. In the meantime, family donations help them stay afloat. Caterina often tells other Americans how she feels lucky. But sometimes people ask her one question she wishes had a different answer.
Could he have applied for a green card because he was married to you? Did you try that route?
Marriage really doesn't mean anything like people think it does because he did have an immigration record before because he had been deported previously.
Recently, Caterina spoke to about 30 Americans gathered at the Rotary Club here in San Miguel. She knows immigration laws are complicated. She's sharing what she's learned the hard way. She held a mic and told what she calls the story of her family's deportation.
I love Arizona, but I've lost faith in the system because I grew up being the white privileged person that I am, is that law enforcement is on your side. Law enforcement is there to protect you. They're supposed to keep your family together. They're the good guys. After being married to someone undocumented, I no longer feel that way.
Caterina doesn't think her husband should have to leave the country he's lived most of his life in because he made one mistake 8 years ago. She said he also paid his dues more than most Americans. He was held between jail and immigration detention for over 180 days. Talking to her 5-year-old about all of this has been the hardest, she told the group.
Why we're here, why Dad can't go back. Like, he's pretty smart. He gets it. I told him it's grown-up problems, but he still worries.
Caterina said moving to Mexico wasn't a sacrifice. she surrendered.
You know, I think it's harder for my husband because he feels like he took us away from something that is better. But I don't feel like that. I feel like there's a difference between sacrifice and surrender. And I feel like sacrifice is leaving something that you think is better for something less better, less good, you know. And surrender is just pulling on all of the tools around you and all of the experiences and just creating the best life possible with what you have around you for your children.
Caterina sees advantages of raising her children in a new culture and away from some of the anti-immigrant discourse in the U.S., in a place where her family won't fear being separated, a stark contrast to how she felt in the U.S. For The World, Valeria Fernandez, San Miguel de Allende, Mexico.
Valeria's story was produced with support from the International Women Media Foundation. You can find more of her reporting on the Barón family, from Jesus' deportation to their new life in Mexico, at PRI.org. A different sort of family story for you now. Fidel Castro's oldest son, Fidel Castro Díaz-Balart, has died at the age of 68. Cuban state media reported that he committed suicide after months of treatment for depression. He was known as Fidelito, Little Fidel, because he looked so much like his father, but the two were actually very different. Fidel, of course, was the communist revolutionary who ruled over Cuba for nearly half a century. Fidelito was a nuclear scientist who shied away from the spotlight. I asked my BBC colleague Will Grant in Havana what Fidelito's relationship was like with his father.
It was a difficult one. Fidel Castro was very aloof to his family. Everything was subservient to the revolution. Obviously, Fidel Castro was also a very demanding leader, and one expects he would have been a demanding father too. But that may have been what made Fidelito such a determined and successful man, because he did end up speaking four languages, very respected scientist in his field, and clearly was known in Cuba for his work, as opposed to being simply Fidel Castro's son.
I hear, actually, at one point, Fidel fired his son from a government job?
That's right, for incompetence, supposedly. Apparently, he stood him down and rebuked him as head of the Cuban nuclear program. And it's hard to know exactly what went on behind the doors of power in that period in Cuba. I think beyond that, it's very clear that Fidel Castro was prepared to put his family to one side and do whatever he deemed necessary for the betterment of the revolution.
I mean, there's an interesting bit of irony here, because Fidelito Díaz-Balart is related to the super anti-communist Florida politicians, Representative Mario Díaz-Balart and former Congressman Lincoln Díaz-Balart. When Cubans talk about Fidelito's death, are they talking about that?
No, absolutely. I mean, can you imagine of a more ideologically split family than the Castro Díaz-Balarts? You know, on the one hand, you have Fidel Castro, and on the other hand, you have Rafael Díaz-Balart, the father of Lincoln and Marion, who was a member of the Batista government. And then, as you mentioned, the sons were prominent politicians in Florida. They are cousins of Fidelito. They have taken such staunchly anti-Castro positions throughout their careers. But such is the nature, I guess, of the Castro revolution. You're either with it when it comes to being a member of the family, or you're against it. You know, there's no real half measures. That said, I think Fidelito himself was very intelligent in the way that he was able to straddle not both worlds. He was clearly part of the revolution. He was a loyal revolutionary, but he was a more nuanced interviewee. He had subtlety in his answers. But clearly there was a great conflict going on there and mental health issues that really, I think, to most Cubans wouldn't have been clear until his death was announced that he'd taken his own life, which would have come as a great surprise.
So finally, Will, what does it mean to Cubans that Fidelito has died?
The comparison I made, in a sense, was with John Junior Kennedy. So not necessarily a hugely influential figure in political life in the United States, or in this instance in Cuba with Fidelito. Not someone necessarily who changed the course of the country or anything like that, but children of very influential and very important 20th century figures in their respective countries, and a sense of sort of collective sadness that a person's life ended in tragic circumstances. I think those two men would have enjoyed a rum and a cigar if life had given them the opportunity to do so. But, you know, these are the circumstances that can happen to any family. A man taking his life, even as late as 68, you know, happens all over the world. And simply because his surname is Castro, I guess doesn't make him any different in that regard.
My BBC colleague, Will Grant, in Havana. Thanks very much, Will.
You're very welcome.
Let's return now to a story we hit recently on the show and will no doubt continue to do. It's about Cape Town, South Africa, and how the city of almost 4 million people is running out of water. The drought is so bad that the city's making plans to shut off the water supply and start strict rationing. They're calling it day zero, the day the taps are turned off. And unless something changes, that'll come in just a couple of months in early April. Here's my BBC colleague, Andrew Harding.
It's almost like a game here in Cape Town. Who can save the most water?
When we wash our lettuce, for example, we'll wash it in a sink.
The hotel chefs are playing it.
And then you reuse that water to mop the floors.
Hello!
The comedians are riffing on it.
You know Neighbourhood Watch?
No.
Well, we have Neighbourhood Wash. That's where the neighbour has come to you to watch.
And the internet is full of people offering tips and, of course, filming themselves in the shower.
There you go. 3 litres of water is all you need.
The enthusiasm is impressive, and it's helped Cape Town to reduce its water consumption by nearly half, but it's not enough.
Cape Town is currently facing its worst drought ever. The city would like to thank each and every resident who has been reusing greywater and doing everything they can to save the water we have left. But not enough residents are actively saving.
3 years of unprecedented and unexpected drought have emptied the reservoirs and pushed Cape Town close to calamity.
The crisis is now. We're running out of water. We're looking at that glass. It's no longer half full. It's now half empty.
Climate scientist Peter Johnson blames global warming and offers few consolations.
Well, you see, the day zero is now real. There's a good chance that we're not going to get significant rains in the next 2 months. It really is. So it's a real situation. The dams, you can go and look at them. They are very, very low. So it is in your face right now. And although some people don't take it seriously, they are still going to face the same consequences as everybody else.
That means switching taps off and introducing acute water rationing. Come April and day zero, that means 25 litres per person per day.
Oh, I think it's going to get much worse. So it's best if we start piling up water now already.
You know, if everybody do their bit, it will be fine.
But it seems like a lot of people aren't doing what's right.
Ah, yeah, you always get that. You'll always get that.
Councillor Xanthia Lindberg is leading the city's preparations.
If people don't have water, if they're queuing, if there's panic, you could have a situation here where you need a state of emergency.
Well, these are all of the very real risks and realities that we might have to face. This is why our disaster risk plan has brought on board the South African Police Force as well as the Army so that we can attempt to maintain law and order as much as possible.
In the meantime, the authorities are drilling into underground aquifers, building desalination plants to convert seawater, and battling with the national government for more funding. But the expectation is that droughts and restrictions will be the new normal here.
The BBC's Andrew Harding reporting from Cape Town, South Africa. We conclude proceedings today on the show in Canada. Canada. Yeah, that's the title of Canada's national anthem. But I'm also remarking, oh, Canada, because that line, true patriot love in all thy sons command, well, the Canadian Parliament passed a bill on Wednesday making it more gender inclusive.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land, true patriot love in all of us command.
That's the Right Honourable Kim Campbell, former Prime Minister of Canada. She's one of several well-known Canadian women who've been pushing to change that line in the anthem for several years.
The original version was true patriot love in us thou dost command, which is a bit archaic. In 1913, it was changed to true patriot love in all thy sons command. So for 100 years, people have suggested, or certainly in the last few decades, that all thy son's command tends to be a little bit partial, and it seems to exclude the daughters. So in all of us command means everybody.
It makes sense. I mean, why is it important to you that Canada's national anthem is gender neutral?
You know, it's interesting. People say, well, you know, sons includes daughters. Well, no, it doesn't. We do sometimes use the term man or men when we're speaking about humankind. But even that's diminished much over the last few decades. We don't say chairman so much. We say chairperson. So I think these small details are important. And I used to say to people, explain to a five-year-old girl why she is a son. She's not. Nobody ever introduces their children of both sexes and saying, I'd like you to meet my sons. You'd think they were ridiculous. These are my sons and daughters. And I might add that I heard from somebody who was first-generation Canadian that the line, all thy sons command, also seemed to refer to people who were, you know, native-born, that didn't seem to include immigrants. But all of us command is really wonderfully inclusive.
And remind me what the very first line was in the 1908 version when O Canada was
composed. I think it, true patriot love, in us thou dost command.
Yeah, so it sounds like this gender-neutral version that's just been introduced kind of brings a Canadian anthem more into line with the original.
Yeah, I mean, the original words, we don't use the second person singular form anymore. You know, we don't say thou dost. We would say true patriot love, in us you do command. But in all of us, command is even nicer. It's a kind of inclusive, embracing turn of phrase.
And the Sing All of Us campaign, tell us a little bit about it. When did it start and how did you get involved?
Well, I got involved more as a kind of an honorary patron and supporter because I've been singing this for 30 years. And when I was in office, I used to say, you know, I sing All of Us command. But it wasn't something where I was really in a position to do much about it in the sense that you don't want it to be too political. So the movement kind of grew. And it's interesting because conservatives in parliament were sort of complaining, saying, oh, we need a referendum. But in fact, the conservative government of Stephen Harper tried to make this change. And there was a big backlash because, of course, people say, oh, you can't touch the national anthem. Well, in fact, there were big changes made in the 1970s. O Canada, glorious and free became God keep our land glorious and free. And Stand on Guard, O Canada, we stand on guard for thee, became From Far and Wide, O Canada, we stand on guard for thee. So people have been tinkering with the anthem throughout the century. So yes, people will get up in the big thing and say, oh, you know, how can you change this? Well, they aren't the original words. So to somebody to say, well, you know, I marched in the King's uniform in World War II, blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, but if you marched in the King's uniform in World War II, you were not singing the words that children are taught in school today. So, you know, get over it and understand it's a modest change, but it's a political quagmire. What happened was this, you know, wonderful member of parliament, Maurice Bélanger, who, you know, as his final gesture as a member of parliament before he died of Lou Gehrig's disease, moved a private member's bill that then passed in the House. And then it got stuck in the Senate. But happily, our senators are appointed, not elected. So they finally, you know, drew themselves up and passed it. And, you know, I think it will be a tempest in a teapot and people will get used to it. It is 2018. You know, it's 25 years since I was prime minister and I'm still the only woman who's done it. You know, maybe if we say in all of us command, we will be sincere in meaning that we mean everybody is out there being a citizen.
So you were involved. I hear Margaret Atwood got involved. It sounds like All Thy Sons didn't really stand a chance of survival.
Oddly enough, I mean, it is harder to change than to maintain it. But it's interesting because many years ago, the CBC created a program called Canada Reads, where different well-known people sponsored or supported a book and the population voted. And my book that I was supporting was Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale. And we didn't win. But what is so interesting is that now her book, The Handmaid's Tale, has now had a huge new lease on life and TV show and all this kind of stuff. And I think because people are starting to be a bit concerned about the return of misogynist policies and constraints on women. So sometimes you have to hit the right moment. So Margaret Atwood has always been a feminist and strong supporter of women's rights, as I have. But sometimes you have to wait for the ripe moment. And I think that there's a whole combination of things, looking south of the border and seeing a president who kind of has given people permission to return to a very misogynist and sexist form of discourse, that really is kind of shocking. So, you know, I think, you know, the time was ripe. And so I don't like to take credit for it. I was one of many who supported it, but I think the time was ripe.
You can take credit, though, for being Canada's first and only female prime minister. What kind of impact do you think, then, making this national anthem gender neutral will have on the country?
It's a tile in the mosaic of progress. You know, it alone of itself is not going to make a difference, but it's a piece of a puzzle that accords dignity. You know, as I say, how do you explain to a five-year-old girl that you're singing All Thy Sons Command? But all right, dear, that includes you. No, it doesn't. So now we're being honest about who we are, who us is.
Canada's national anthem, of course, has an English and a French version. Will there be any changes to the French version?
I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Well, the French do have a gender-neutral pronoun, en, so I guess
yes.
It may not be.
Well, the other thing, too, is it's very much about war and fighting and all this kind of stuff, and it's more religious than the English language version. But, you know, I will leave it to my francophone compatriots to decide whether they think their version needs to be tinkered with. All of us was a big enough battle.
Kim Campbell, the former Prime Minister of Canada, thanks very much for telling us about the Sing All of Us campaign.
My pleasure. It's great for all of us.
And that'll do it for us today. Our own theme music, our anthem, was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. You all have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.